This is Audible.
Broadside Books and Harper Audio present The Right Side of History, How Reason and Moral Purpose Made the West Great, by Ben Shapiro. This is the author. Introduction. This book is about two mysteries. The first mystery, why are things so good? The second mystery, why are we blowing it? Human beings spent tens of thousands of years living in dire poverty, under subsistence conditions, in constant threat of physical danger both from nature and from other human beings. For nearly all of human history, life has been nasty, brutish, and short. In 1900, some 10% of all infants died before reaching their first birthday in the United States. In other countries, the number was far higher. Approximately one in every 100 mothers could expect to die in childbirth. Yet we now live in an era in which mothers can expect to survive pregnancy and childbirth. The mortality rate among pregnant women has dropped 99%. Babies can be expected to survive infancy and then live another 8 decades. We live in an era in which the vast majority of the American population lives in climate-controlled spaces with plenty of food, a car, and at least one television. We can speak with each other across thousands of miles instantaneously, find and collate information with the touch of a few keys, send money seamlessly whirring around the globe, and buy products manufactured in dozens of different places for cents on the dollar without leaving our homes. Then there are our freedoms. We can expect that a baby born in the United States will never be enslaved, murdered, or tortured. An adult in the United States can go about his or her daily business with the expectation that she will not be arrested for espousing an unpopular viewpoint or worshiping the wrong god or no god at all. There are no restrictions barring particular races or genders from particular jobs, no government rules designed to privilege one particular biological or religious in-group at the expense of any other out-group. We can live with whom we choose, have as many or as few children as we want, and open any business we see fit. We can expect to die richer than we were born. We don't live in a perfect world, but we do live in the best world that has ever existed. So, the first mystery is this. How did all of this happen? What changed? Then there's the second, more important question. Why are we throwing it away? We are killing ourselves at the highest rates in decades. Rates of depression have skyrocketed. Drug overdoses are now responsible for more deaths than car crashes. Marriage rates have declined, as have childbearing rates. We are spending more money on luxuries and enjoying everything less. Conspiracies have replaced reason, and subjective perceptions have replaced objective observation. Facts have been buried to make way for feelings. A society of essential oils and self-esteem has replaced a society of logic. We're more divided than at any time in the recent past. The exit polls show that on the day of the 2016 election, just 43% of voters had a favorable opinion of Hillary Clinton. 38% of voters had a favorable opinion of Donald Trump. Only 36% of voters thought Hillary was honest and trustworthy. 33% of voters thought Trump was. Fully 53% of Americans said they would feel concerned or scared if Clinton won. 57% of Americans felt that way if Trump won. Never have two more unpopular candidates run against each other. They still both earned millions of votes in support. Not just that. People who were uncomfortable with their candidate vitriolically attacked anyone who voted for the other. They broke off friendships with those who voted differently. In July 2017, Pew Research found that 47% of self-described liberal Democrats said they'd have a tough time staying friends with those who voted for Trump. 13% of conservatives said the same, but it's difficult to say whether that number might have been reversed if Trump had lost. It's also worth noting that fully 47% of Clinton voters said they did not have a single close friend who voted for Trump. A more telling statistic, 68% of Democrats said it was stressful and frustrating to talk to political opponents. 52% of Republicans agreed. something deeper than political differences is going on here. Virtually all of our trust in key institutions has vanished. Gallup polls show that our average trust in 14 key institutions is just 32%. Just 27% of Americans trust banks. Just 20% of Americans trust newspapers. Just 41% of Americans say they trust organized religion. That number is 19% for the federal government overall and 39% for the healthcare system. Only 30% of Americans trust the public schools, 18% trust big business, and 9% trust Congress. We still trust our police, but those numbers have dropped over the past decade, particularly among Democrats. The only thing we still seem to trust is the military, which makes sense since it provides for our common defense. We don't trust each other either. As of 2015, just 52% of Americans said they trusted all or most of their neighbors. Just 31% of blacks and 27% of Hispanics say they can trust their neighbors. Just 46% of Americans say they spend an evening with neighbors even once per month, compared to 61% of Americans who did in 1974. Another 2016 survey showed that just 31% of Americans thought most people can be trusted. As for our democracy, fewer and fewer people like it. An October 2016 poll showed that 40% of Americans said they had lost faith in American democracy, with another 6% stating that they never had faith to begin with. No wonder only 31% of those polled said they would definitely accept the results of an election if their candidate lost. And 80% of Americans said America was more divided today than ever. Ever. Just a reminder, we've had a full-scale civil war in this country, as well as Jim Crow and the domestic terrorism of the 1960s. Brutal division has infused every aspect of our social fabric. We can't watch a football game together without debating the merits of protesting during the national anthem, or watch a television show without falling into debate over representation of women, or go to church without arguing over our vote. We fight harder and more viciously over smaller and smaller matters. The more frivolous the topic, the harsher the battles. What in the world happened? There are some trendy answers. Some blame our current political and social disintegration on heightened economic divides. Many commentators and politicians argue that income inequality has generated unprecedented conflict in American life. They say that too many Americans feel left behind by the new globalized economy, and that either mild protectionism or redistributionism will heal those ills. They argue that the 1% have outpaced the 99%, that urbanites have outpaced rural Americans, that white-collar jobs have outpaced blue-collar jobs. Such economic reductionism seems misplaced. The upper middle class in the United States grew from 12% of Americans in 1979 to 30% as of 2014. Income mobility has not changed significantly in the United States since the 1970s. America has seen far worse economic times. As of this writing, we're living at 4% unemployment with record stock market gains. The Great Depression didn't tear us apart the way we're torn apart today, and our economy has indeed grown steadily since 2009. Economic change has been a constant force in American life, with a long-term upward trend for all demographics. The difference is our social divide, not our wallets. How about race? In this view, our political conflicts are a proxy for deeper racial wounds, which have reopened in recent years. This argument is made most passionately by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who suggested that Barack Obama was Black America's best and final hope, a champion of Black imagination, of Black dreams, and Black possibilities, and that Donald Trump's presidency represents the revenge of white America. To Trump, whiteness is neither notional nor symbolic, but is the very core of his power, Coates recently wrote. In this, Trump is not singular. But whereas his forebears carried whiteness like an ancestral talisman, Trump cracked the glowing amulet open, releasing its eldritch energies. Black Americans, Coates argued, have been cast into a race in which the wind is always at your face and the hounds are always at your heels. The plunder of black life was drilled into this country in its infancy and reinforced across its history, so that plunder has become an heirloom, an intelligence, a sentience, a default setting to which, likely to the end of our days, we must invariably return. The photo negative of Coates' perspective comes courtesy of the racist alt-right movement, which accepts Coates' characterization of American politics, but sees things in reverse. An America overrun by identity politics of racial minorities. The alt-right loves Coates' characterization of white America as all-powerful. As Richard Spencer told New York Times Magazine contributing writer Thomas Chatterton Williams, "This is why I'm actually very confident, because maybe those leftists will be the easiest ones to flip." More than that, the alt-right also sees the world in terms of a race war, one they hope one day to finally win. However, racial divides can't explain our current crisis. Racial conflagrationists have always existed in the United States. This is still the country that endured slavery and Jim Crow. Have things really gotten worse since then in terms of race? In truth, we're more racially equal than ever before in our history, more equal than any other society in human history. In 1958, just 4% of Americans approved of black-white intermarriage. As of 2013, that statistic was 87%. In that year, 72% of white Americans thought race relations were good, and so did 66% of black Americans. That statistic had remained relatively stable from 2001 through 2013. And yet, our racial battles are now bloody and brutal, with renewed tribalism raging on all sides. By July 2016, just 53% of Americans said race relations were good, while 46% said they were bad. Something is indeed falling apart, but it's hard to attribute that collapse to a resurgence of racist sentiment. A third popular argument explaining our national disintegration suggests technology as the culprit. Social media, we hear, is dividing us more than ever. We are hunkering down in our bubbles, speaking only to those who agree with us. We only follow those we like on social media. We're engaging in social situations less and less frequently. If we all sit in our living rooms and avoid one another, interacting only to prop up our preconceived notions, we're less likely to see those who disagree as brothers and sisters. Mostafa El-Bermawi of Wired.com suggests, from your Facebook feed to your Google search, as your experience online grows increasingly personalized, the internet's islands keep getting more segregated and soundproofed. Without realizing it, we develop tunnel vision. This is an attractive theory, but according to researchers, there's not much evidence to support it. According to economics professors at Stanford and Brown, political polarization is taking place more for demographic groups least likely to use the internet and social media. Polarization seems to cross demographic boundaries without reference to level of technological use. Finally, there's the most basic argument of all. For whatever reason, human nature has kicked back in. We are naturally tribal, naturally possessive, naturally angry. For a while, we suppressed those instincts. We called that the Enlightenment. Jonah Goldberg, in his masterful Suicide of the West, calls that overthrow of human instinct the miracle. Steven Pinker, author of Enlightenment Now, makes a similar case. He says that the Enlightenment changed everything, that it brought about science and humanism, reason and progress. Enlightenment thinking substituted rationality for irrationality, and the effect was the creation of the modern world. Goldberg, arguing that Enlightenment ideals are unnatural, says that our current dissolution looks like a reversion to our tribal, reactionary nature. Pinker agrees. But this answer doesn't explain why, precisely, modernity ever should have burst forth in the first place. If human nature cuts against the liberalism and capitalism and humanism and science, then what caused them to bloom? More important, this answer doesn't explain why we're tearing down these powerful forces now, as opposed to any time in the past two centuries. I believe these two questions are intimately related. This book argues that Western civilization, including our modern notions of values and reason and science, was built on deep foundations. And this book argues that we're tossing away what's best about our civilization because we've forgotten that those foundations even exist. So, where did this book come from? It came from my sense, widely reflected, I think, that we're tearing each other apart. That realization hit me on a precise date, February 25th, 2016. Late in 2015, I'd started a speaking tour on college campuses, heading first to the University of Missouri. That campus exploded into the national news after Black Lives Matter protests against the administration. The football team vowed not to take the field for a scheduled game, despite the administration's overzealous response to vague reports of isolated racist incidents, some of which were completely unsubstantiated. Student protesters declared a hunger strike, formed an encampment, and refused access to journalists. One professor, Melissa Click, infamously asked for someone to physically manhandle a student reporter seeking to cover the event. I gave a speech to students on campus, viewed 500,000 times online within a week. I posited that all people of good heart wanted to fight racism, but that vague charges of institutional racism and white privilege obscured individual evil and slandered the country more broadly. I attended the speech without security. Everything went well despite an attempt to pull the fire alarm, and students lined up for a broad-based question and answer session too. Just 3 months later came the rude awakening. I was scheduled to give a speech to the Young Americas Foundation group at California State University at Los Angeles. 2 weeks in advance of the speech, we began hearing rumblings about protests. The week before the speech, the president of the university announced that the event had been canceled outright. I refused to accede to that clear breach of First Amendment rights. My taxpayer dollars had gone to the California State University system, after all, and I announced that I would show up anyway. My business partner, Jeremy Boring, insisted I bring a security team, but I was pretty skeptical. After all, I'd never needed security for any event. This wasn't Fallujah. This was a major college campus in the middle of my home city. Just to be safe, Jeremy hired security anyway. Thank God I listened. On the day of the scheduled event, our security team began hearing rumors that violence was in the offing. An hour before the event, the president of the university announced that he would back down and that police would protect the speech. As we approached the campus, we could see helicopters swirling overhead. We pulled into a parking lot behind the auditorium, and dozens of armed, uniformed police quickly formed a cordon and rushed me through the back door. I was puzzled more than anything else. The security precautions didn't end there. Backstage were another dozen cops. Hundreds of student protesters had filled the hallway outside the auditorium, and they had blocked off all the entrances. A few rioters were physically assaulting students who wanted to enter. The police set up a backdoor route, but could only sneak students in two at a time. I put my ear to the auditorium door. It sounded like a zombie apocalypse outside. Members of the police department said that the administration had told them to stand down and allow the protesters to do whatever they pleased. The police offered us a choice. We could wait for 2 hours while they filled the room, or we could go ahead with the speech. We decided to go ahead despite the mostly empty auditorium and despite the near riot happening just outside the door. As the speech progressed, students pulled the fire alarm. The lights went out and the alarm began beeping loudly. Students continued pounding the doors outside. I spoke through the Discord, announcing that the disruptors wouldn't stop us from exercising our free speech rights. As I finished, I turned to those in the audience. I was more than a bit amped up by this point, and asked if they wanted to go outside and mingle with the protesters. They responded in the affirmative, at which point my security team and the police pulled me backstage. "If you go outside," one of the officers warned me, "we can protect you from the first guy who throws a punch, and the second guy, but not the third guy. Also, we won't be able to protect all the students here if they walk out with you. You should leave the campus, and we'll keep all the students inside until the crowd disperses." Duly chastened, I acquiesced to being escorted from campus. The moving cordon of police officers sneaked me out of the forum through back hallways and kitchens, ushered me into a tinted window black van, and guided me from the campus with a police escort flashing their lights. So, what went wrong? I found out later that a professor on campus had been telling her students that I was a white supremacist, that I was akin to a Ku Klux Klan member, that I was a Nazi. I'm just wearing the yarmulke as deep cover, apparently. The students had believed their professors, and they had reacted accordingly. The value of speech had been overthrown in favor of a subjective rage that had nothing to do with facts. This, of course, was just the beginning. At the University of Wisconsin, my speech was nearly shut down by protesters who flooded the front of the stage. At Penn State, protesters gathered outside my speech and pounded on the doors. At DePaul University, the administration threatened to arrest me if I came to campus and called out a Cook County sheriff to do the honors. At Berkeley, the administration called out hundreds of police officers to protect law-abiding citizens from the rage of violent rioters. That wasn't the end of the 2016 circus, however. During the election cycle, I was highly critical of both candidates. As a conservative, I'd been a lifelong critic of Hillary Clinton. But I was also highly critical of Donald Trump. Thanks to my criticisms of Trump, and thanks to my very public break with Breitbart News, an outlet I believed had become a propaganda tool for the Trump campaign, I quickly found myself targeted by a new breed of radical. In late March, the execrable Milo Yiannopoulos penned a story at Breitbart, openly praising the alt-right, including odes to racist cretins like Richard Spencer. Egging on his alt-right followers, cheering on their jolly trollery, Milo sent me a picture of a black baby on the day of my son's birth that May, the point being that I was a cuck. Over the course of the 2016 campaign, I would become the top recipient of anti-Semitism among Jewish journalists on the internet, by a huge margin. According to the Anti-Defamation League, approximately 19,253 anti-Semitic tweets were directed at journalists during the August 2015 through July 2016 period. I received 7,400 of those tweets, or 38% of the total. I went through most of my adult life involved in public political conversations with others without threat of violence or racist slur. Now, I required hundreds of police officers to protect me while speaking at a variety of campuses, and my Twitter feed was flooded with images straight from the pages of Der Stürmer. Something, obviously, had changed. Something has changed. We've lost something. This book is my attempt to determine what we've lost and how we can find it. To find what we've lost, we're going to need to retrace our steps. This book is filled with old ideas. Ideas from people we may dimly remember from our days in high school and college and Sunday school, but whose central importance we've essentially forgotten. Those ideas, I'll argue, are crucial. We must learn them anew. This doesn't mean that I believe philosophers changed history on their own. I don't think Adam Smith invented capitalism any more than Immanuel Kant invented morality. But these philosophers and thinkers offer a window into the most important ideas of their time. Tolstoy famously asks in War and Peace, "What moves history?" and concludes that history is merely the progression of all of the various forces at play in the universe channeled into action in a particular moment. There's truth to that, of course. But ideas matter, and important ideas, as best articulated by great thinkers, represent the motivational road along which humanity journeys. We act because we believe. In order to fix ourselves, then, we must re-examine what we believe. We believe freedom is built upon the twin notions that God created every human in his image, and that human beings are capable of investigating and exploring God's world. Those notions were born in Jerusalem and Athens, respectively. Those twin notions, those diamonds of spiritual genius, built our civilization and built us as individuals. If you believe that life is more than materialistic pleasures and pain avoidance, you are a product of Jerusalem and Athens. If you believe that the government has no right to intrude upon the exercise of your individual will, and that you are bound by moral duty to pursue virtue, you are a product of Jerusalem and Athens. If you believe that human beings are capable of bettering our world through use of our reason, and are bound by higher purpose to do so, you are a product of Jerusalem and Athens. Jerusalem and Athens built science. The twin ideals of Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law reasoning built human rights. They built prosperity, peace, and artistic beauty. Jerusalem and Athens built America, ended slavery, defeated the Nazis and the communists, lifted billions from poverty, and gave billions spiritual purpose. Jerusalem and Athens were the foundations of the Magna Carta and the Treaty of Westphalia. They were the foundations of the Declaration of Independence, Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail. Civilizations that rejected Jerusalem and Athens, and the tension between them, have collapsed into dust. The USSR rejected Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law, substituting the values of the collective and a new utopian vision of social justice, and they starved and slaughtered tens of millions of human beings. The Nazis rejected Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law, and they shoved children into gas chambers. Venezuela rejects Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law, and citizens of their oil-rich nation have been reduced to eating dogs. In America, especially with our unique history and success, we have long seen progress and prosperity as our birthright. The conflicts that tear apart other nations are not for us. We certainly don't need to worry about revolution or collapse. We're America. We're different. That sanguine view is utterly wrong. The fight against entropy is never over. Our way of life is never more than one generation away from the precipice. We have already begun to see a huge number of our citizens lose faith in free speech, in democracy, in economic freedom, in the idea of a shared morality or cause. That turn away from our values began when we lost faith in the path that brought us here in the first place. We are in the process of abandoning Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law, favoring moral subjectivism and the rule of passion. And we are watching our civilization collapse into age-old tribalism, individualistic hedonism, and moral subjectivism. Make no mistake, we are still living off the prosperity of the world built by Jerusalem and Athens. We believe we can reject Judeo-Christian values and Greek natural law and satisfy ourselves with intersectionality, or scientific materialism, or progressive politics, or authoritarian governance, or nationalistic solidarity. We can't. We've spent the last two centuries carving ourselves off from the roots of our civilization. Our civilization could survive and thrive, for a time. Then it began to die from the inside out. Our civilization is riddled with internal contradictions, communities bereft of values, and individuals bereft of meaning. The economies of the West aren't going to die overnight. Stacking socialist programs atop capitalist infrastructures won't immediately collapse the West. But we flatter ourselves to believe that we can abandon the values of the past and somehow survive indefinitely. Philosophically, the West has been running on fumes for generations. We are viewing birth rates plummet and government spending skyrocket across the West, and we are watching large swaths of immigrants unfamiliar with Western values imported to fill the gap, resulting in polarizing backlash. We are watching European politics devolve into a battle between far-left socialists who promise utopia and far-right nationalists who promise national restoration. Both are bound to fail. And though America lags behind, America is following the European path. The ties that bind us together are fraying. Those ties were forged through fire and water, reason and prayer. The journey to modernity was a long road. That road wasn't always pretty. Often, it was violent. The tension between Jerusalem and Athens is real. But removing the tension by abandoning either Jerusalem or Athens collapses the bridge built between the two. To strengthen our civilization, then, we must examine how the bridge was built. It took Western civilization 3,000 years to get here. We can lose it all in one generation unless we begin shoring up our foundations. We must stop chipping away, and we must start retrofitting. That task requires us to re-examine those foundations, brick by brick. In this book, we'll re-examine those foundations. We'll be moving through thousands of years of philosophy and history, which means we'll inevitably be giving great philosophers shorter shrift than they deserve and simplifying issues for the sake of brevity. This book won't tell you all you need to know about any of these ideas and philosophers, not even close. That means you should pursue further the specific ideas that interest you, with people more expert than I, in more detail. And for my part, I've tried to restrict my philosophical synopses to points upon which there seemed to be general agreement. But this book does represent my attempt to dive into those ideas in the most user-friendly way in pursuit of wisdom about the essential questions of our civilization. So, let us begin at the beginning. Chapter 9. The Return to Paganism. In 2015, I appeared on CNN HLN's Dr. Drew Show. The topic was ESPN's decision to award Caitlyn Jenner their Arthur Ashe Courage Award for his decision to announce his transgenderism. Caitlyn Jenner is, of course, a biological male. Several different people comprised the panel for Dr. Drew's show. One of them was Zoe Turr, a transgender female and biological male. The conversation began with a unanimous vote of approval for ESPN's decision, until I was asked about the situation. I explained that I didn't understand why society ought to engage in the mass delusion that Jenner was in fact a woman. Jenner may call himself a trans woman, Jenner may change his name, but Jenner is not, by any biological metric, a woman. And a society that refuses to acknowledge the biological differences between men and women is engaging in knowing falsehood. This rather simple statement drew Turr's ire. Turr proceeded to berate and belittle me for my perspective, calling me an ignorant little boy. I responded by reiterating that Jenner is a biological male, and that believing you are a member of the opposite sex is a mental disorder, that men cannot magically become women, and women cannot magically become men. After Turr responded again with insults, I finally asked Turr, "What are your genetics, sir?" The question wasn't meant as a provocation. It was meant to make a point. Biology matters. Facts matter. Reason matters. But at this point, all hell broke loose. Turr grabbed me by the back of the neck on national television and threatened to send me home in an ambulance. An odd offer, since you don't usually go home in an ambulance. Other members of the panel reacted with horror to my insulting the pronouns. Needless to say, none of this had to do with reason. Unfortunately, reason is no longer in vogue. That's why when I visited Berkeley to speak, protesters outside chanted, "Speech is violence." It's why I, an Orthodox Jew and the leading antagonist of the racist alt-right, have been routinely castigated as a Nazi. Subjectivity rules the day. Reason, in fact, is insulting. Reason suggests that one person can know better than another, that one person's perspective can be more correct than someone else's. Reason is intolerant. Reason demands standards. Better to destroy reason than to abide by its dictates. After the enormous human developments brought about by the exercise of reason, all this should seem bizarre. But the death of reason could have been predicted once reason alone failed to provide us with meaning. The existentialist philosophy of Jaspers, Heidegger, and Sartre left man alone at the edge of the cosmos, an odd conglomeration of stardust, sentient but purposeless, incapable of making sense of the chaotic universe around him. All logic could be deconstructed into interplay of social forces. All individual decision-making could be degraded to the level of reactionary biology. None of this was new, of course. It was merely a return to a very old way of thinking, a pagan way of thinking. Where the Greeks had insisted on a telos discoverable in the universe by way of investigating nature and thereby piercing through to the unmoved mover's design, the post-World War II West discarded telos altogether. Where Judeo-Christian values had insisted on a unified master plan, an objective moral standard, a progression in history, and the inescapable importance of free choice, the post-World War II West substituted chaos and subjectivism. For the Enlightenment thinkers, science had ripped man from his place at the center of the universe, but reason could restore him to the center of meaning. However, this was no longer true, thanks to the new knowledge of science. God was dead at the hands of man. Now man was dead at his own hands. There was no grand design behind the confusion of everyday life. Human morality was just that, a construct created by some at the expense of others. History was not a story of progress, but a story of oppression and suffering. As Voltaire wrote in Geno e Colli, "All ancient histories, as one of our wits has observed, are only fables that men have agreed to admit as true. With regard to modern history, it is a mere chaos, a confusion which it is impossible to make anything of." And individual human beings had no power of choice. They were corks bobbing on the eddies of time. The story of humanity was over. Human beings were animals once again. Unless purveyors of Athens and Jerusalem had been wrong all along. What if those purveyors of Athens and Jerusalem, those creators of the Constitution and the Magna Carta, those thinkers behind the scientific method and deductive reasoning, what if they had all pulled a fast one? What if, as it turned out, man was born free but was everywhere in chains because of these systems of thought themselves? What if objective truth was a trap? What if reason was a trap? What if the system of rights promoted by the Enlightenment was actually a cleverly disguised method for enshrining the power of the few at the expense of the many? What if the system itself could be torn down? And if the system could be torn down, how could it be torn down? The answer, as it turns out, was simple enough. By rejection of all prevailing societal norms in favor of precisely the tribal paganism and animalistic passion that had preceded those norms. Only by going back to the beginning could humanity be built again from scratch. Everything had to be torn down in order to be built back up again. Baiting the Babbitts. This was a bigger problem in the United States than it was in Europe. Europe had been devastated by war. Europe had discarded religion long ago. But in the United States, the post-World War II situation looked bright. Unlike in Europe, religious practice remained incredibly strong. As of 1950, about three-quarters of Americans were members of a church, synagogue, or mosque. In 1954, almost half of all Americans said they had attended church, synagogue, or mosque in the last 7 days. Over 9 in 10 Americans identified as Christian. This didn't mean that America was full of dead-eyed androids praising Jesus and stumping for segregation and sexism. Jim Crow remained in full evil force in the South. Sexism remained a serious obstacle to women. But the 1950s and early 1960s saw the rise of a burgeoning black middle class. As Thomas Sowell points out, from 1954 to 1964, the number of blacks in professional, technical, and similar high-level positions more than doubled. In other kinds of occupations, the advance of blacks was even greater during the 1940s, when there was little or no civil rights policy, than during the 1950s, when the civil rights revolution was in its heyday. And the number of women in the workplace had been rising steadily for decades. In 1950, 1 in 3 women were in the workforce, as compared to just 19% of working-age women 50 years earlier. Across the board, American living standards changed radically for the better as the United States took global leadership. Furthermore, America was hardly a cultural desert. The attempt to paint the American dream as an American nightmare had common currency on the American left. Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, 1922, painted a businessman as an unfulfilled dreamer, coining the term Babbitt as an insult for everyday Americans. But in the aftermath of World War II, the American dream was still very much alive. And that dream was never merely a white picket fence, a dog, and 2 kids out in suburbia. It was a dream of cultural enrichment and common purpose. As Fred Siegel reports, between 1940 and 1955, local symphony orchestras increased 250%. In 1955, 35 million people paid to attend symphonies, as opposed to 15 million people paying to attend baseball games. Even early television became part of the cultural education of the public. NBC presented a 3-hour production of Laurence Olivier's Richard III. As of 1951, there were 25,000 members of the Great Books discussion groups, with 50,000 Americans a year buying collections of the writings of Plato, Aristotle, the Founding Fathers, and Hegel, at serious cost to themselves. But the American left could not accept that a capitalistic America could produce a more cultured America and a more tolerant America. Thus, the argument went, the growing wealth and culture of the American middle class was merely a ruse. Deep down in their hearts, Americans were empty pretenders, Stepford wives and Babbitt husbands. They were shallow materialists who shunted human suffering to the back of the bus in favor of their vainglorious pursuit of wealth at all costs. They were repressives who hid pornography beneath the bed and petty jealousy in their hearts. On the other hand, changing the system could bring about a new humanity, a humanity renewed in individual and communal purpose and in individual and communal capacity. Human beings had been fooled into believing that they had purpose and capacity under the Judeo-Christian-supported Enlightenment system. But they could be disabused of that notion. They could be changed for the better, if only the system itself could be reduced to rubble. This argument had deep roots on the Marxist left. Italian socialist Antonio Gramsci, 1891 to 1937, had supposed in 1916 that the failure of World War I to usher in global Marxist revolution was a result of culture, that too many people had grown up under the repressive orthodoxy of capitalism. Man is, above all else, mind, consciousness. That is, he is a product of history, not of nature. There is no other way of explaining why socialism has not come into existence already, he wrote. Gramsci died in an Italian prison under the regime of Mussolini, but his philosophy was picked up by the members of the so-called Frankfurt School, a group of German scholars expelled from Germany amidst the rise of the Nazi Party. Their leader, Max Horkheimer, 1895 to 1973, preached the gospel of social change. and suggested that systems had to be deconstructed in order to make way for that social change. He explained that what he termed critical theory was suspicious of the very categories of better, useful, appropriate, productive, and valuable, as those are understood in the present order. The present order had to change, Horkheimer said, because the wretchedness of our own time is connected with the structure of society. And the way to change it was to tear it down. It is no coincidence that the various forms of university study dedicated to various alleged victim groups, Black studies, Jewish studies, LGBT studies, all find a home under the critical studies rubric. Horkheimer and other members of the Frankfurt School were forced to leave Germany with the rise of the Nazis, but they made their way to the United States with the help of Edward R. Murrow, among others. Leading lights like Theodore Adorno, 1903 to 1969, posited that American culture was replete with anti-revolutionary materialism. Eric Fromm, 1900 to 1980, suggested that the roots of totalitarianism could be found in the materialism he saw in the United States. Fromm stated that fascism would rise in the United States thanks to its devotion to capitalism. Individuals had been alienated from society by its consumerism, made into widgets. Indeed, we are not free. We only think we are, thanks to the lies of the Enlightenment and Western civilization. We are proud that we are not subject to any external authority, Fromm writes, that we are free to express our thoughts and feelings, and we take it for granted that this freedom almost automatically guarantees our individuality. The right to express our thoughts, however, means something only if we are able to have thoughts of our own. The powerlessness of Western man could only find solace in compulsive conforming, in the process of which the isolated individual becomes an automaton, or in the authoritarian character. Without Marxist remolding, men became either Nazis or the trite little consumers of modern America, who, in turn, would become proto-fascists. This was a dire and deliberate misreading of the nature of American individualism, which rested on Judeo-Christian values and Greek reason. Fromm wasn't wrong that the replacement of individual and communal purpose with base materialism is a problem, but his diagnosis, the destruction of the American value system rather than its restoration, was dramatically off. Nazism didn't arise from consumerism. It arose from communal purpose overriding individual purpose, and from individual capacity abandoned in favor of worship of the communal capacity of the state. Nazism, in other words, lay a lot closer to Marxism than capitalism did. But Fromm and thinkers like him suggested that the solution to the supposedly inevitable slide from dull consumerist conformity to horrible fascism lay in complete rebellion. Only acts of rebellion could destroy the system from within. Rebellion in sex, rebellion in art, rebellion in work, rebellion everywhere. The leading advocate of that rebellion was Herbert Marcuse, 1898 to 1979. Marcuse, one of the progenitors of the so-called New Left, preached that the prevailing order had to be torn out root and branch. In 1955, coincident with the rise of Kinsey's thought, Marcuse penned Eros and Civilization, in which he argued that repressive sexuality had damaged mankind and that only freeing man of his Victorian mentality regarding sex could build a better world. Like Kinsey, Marcuse rejected Freud. Instead, he posited a world of liberated Eros and called for the concept of a non-repressive civilization based on a fundamentally different experience of being, a fundamentally different relation between man and nature, and fundamentally different existential relations. Capitalism had structured adults so that they fell into patterns of labor specialization, and that same logic held true for sex, where certain body parts were for certain things. But no more. Now, the body in its entirety would become an object of cathexis, a thing to be enjoyed, an instrument of pleasure. Everything would become happy and wonderful as human beings finally gloried in their total self-realization. No longer employed as instruments for attaining men in alienated performances, the barriers against absolute gratification would become elements of human freedom. This sensuous rationality contains its own moral laws. Unbridled Dionysian paganism, and the world would become free. No wonder Marcuse's popular slogan ran, "Make love, not war." Students in Paris during the 1968 revolt carried banners reading Marx, Mao, and Marcuse. But Marcuse's pagan revelry didn't stop with revolutionary sex. The capstone to his theory came in the form of censorship, what he called, in Orwellian fashion, repressive tolerance. Marcuse suggested that certain forms of speech had to be barred so that they could not emerge victorious, toppling critical theory itself. According to Marcuse, The objective of tolerance would call for intolerance toward prevailing policies, attitudes, opinions, and the extension of tolerance to policies, attitudes, and opinions which are outlawed or suppressed. Freedom, Marcuse said, was serving the cause of oppression. Oppression, therefore, could serve the cause of freedom. Speech could be labeled violence. Marcuse called to re-examine the issue of violence and the traditional distinction between violent and nonviolent action. And violence could be labeled speech. In essence, liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. It would extend to the stage of action, as well as of discussion and propaganda, of deed, as well as of word. The marketplace of ideas had to die, since it was organized and delimited by those who determined the national and the individual interest. Minority groups had to be given special privileges to shut down opposition. Liberation of the damned of the earth presupposes suppression, not only of their old, but also of their new masters. The roots of sexual liberation, victim politics, and political correctness had been laid. The left properly pointed out the widespread problems of racism and sexism in American society in the 1950s, and their diagnosis was to destroy the system utterly. That diagnosis was self-serving. Since Marx, the left had seen Western civilization as the problem, a hierarchy of property owners seeking to suppress their supposed inferiors. Now, the left claimed that all the ills of society could be laid at the feet of the system they so despised. And young Americans, living through the turbulent social change of the 1960s, resonated to that message. In the 1960s and 1970s, the counterculture, which saw America as a place replete with evil and suffering, became the dominant culture in academia and the media. I'm on the right track, baby. If the system was to blame for all human shortcomings, then the answers could be found by pursuing your truth. Virtue, it turns out, was part of that old-style hierarchy that had kept humanity penned in for millennia. No, people merely had to find themselves. This newfangled gloss on Rousseauian romanticism found ecstatic followers on the new left. Where once conscience had reigned supreme, now self-fulfillment became the key to self-betterment. The psychological theory of Abraham Maslow, 1908 to 1970, was hijacked to support this new journey within. Maslow said that human beings sought self-realization, not the pursuit of virtue through acting in accordance with an objective telos, but realization of what you truly want. Repression prevents us from realizing what we want and need, and such repression begins in childhood, mostly as a response to parental and cultural disapprovals. We should seek our inner nature, which is definitely not evil, but is either what we adults in our culture call good, or else it is neutral. By removing repression, we can unlock our own good. Dr. Benjamin Spock's 1903-1998 Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, 1946, which sold 50 million copies between its publication and Spock's death in 1998, placed the same emphasis on self-esteem. Spock, a devotee of the New Left, had told parents to put aside the rigidity of old-school parenting, which could instill insecurity and anxiety. Instead, parents should follow their instincts and refrain from criticizing their children. Spock admitted that his initial draft of the book led many parents to believe that they had to bend over for their children. Parents began to be afraid to impose on the child in any way, he said. Spock actually would change his book to emphasize parental standards in later editions. But Spock did believe in a notion of natural man as inherently good. John Dewey and Freud said that kids don't have to be disciplined into adulthood, but can direct themselves toward adulthood by following their own will, Spock stated in 1972 while running for president on the People's Party ticket. His platform included free medical care, full withdrawal of all American troops from foreign countries, and a guaranteed minimum income. This was hot stuff in the 1960s and 1970s. Nathaniel Brandon, 1930 to 2014, famously Ayn Rand's paramour and an early objectivist, penned the bestselling The Psychology of Self-Esteem, in which he stated that the central human search was for self-esteem, and that self-esteem could be achieved only through rational appraisal. He attacked the doctrine of original sin and argued that the will to understand could grant purpose. Later, Brandon would write that there was not a single psychological problem, from anxiety and depression to fear of intimacy or of success to spouse battery or child molestation, that is not traceable to the problem of poor self-esteem. Now, Maslow and Spock and Brandon may have argued that self-esteem still had to be earned, but that message was quickly shunted aside in favor of a simple headline version of their philosophy. Elevating self-esteem had to be pursued at all costs. If fulfillment lay in self-esteem, then children had to be taught that they were special. Furthermore, if values and standards stood in the way of self-esteem, then those values and standards had to be obliterated for the sake of true self-realization. Politicians began to echo the idea that children were owed a culture of self-esteem. As Jesse Singel of The Cut writes, the self-esteem craze changed how countless organizations were run, how an entire generation, millennials, was educated, and how that generation went on to perceive itself, quite favorably. As Singel also points out, the social science to suggest that crime and suffering would be minimized with the maximization of self-esteem was junk. It turns out not that self-esteem makes people more high-achieving, but that more high-achieving people tend to have higher self-esteem thanks to their achievements. The true effect wasn't to create generations of more fulfilled human beings, though. It was to create generations of more self-obsessed human beings. But society was quick to embrace the self-esteem movement, the notion that everyone's feelings were to be honored in order to prevent crucial loss of self-esteem. Barney sang to countless school children, "Oh, you are special, special, everyone is special, everyone in his or her own way." And as they grew, Lady Gaga would sing to them, "Just love yourself and you're set. I'm on the right track, baby. I was born this way." Where children had once learned from Pinocchio to always let your conscience be your guide, now they were taught by Frozen, "No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Let it go." Or, most crudely, Americans might hear that you and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals who ought to do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. Not exactly the transcendental uplift of Psalms or Beethoven. Natural law had become nature. And through reveling in their nature, rather than channeling it, human beings could finally find their bliss. The rise of intersectionality. For the advocates of the Frankfurt School, the point of focusing on self-esteem was obvious. If they focused instead on the spread of material prosperity, they'd have to give up Marxism in favor of Judeo-Christian values-supported capitalism. By focusing on self-esteem, however, the new left could kill three birds with one stone. They could overturn reliance on Judeo-Christian religion, Greek teleology, and capitalism. Religion, Greek teleology, and capitalism all have something in common. None of them cares particularly much about your bliss. Religion suggests that your self-realization lies in consonance with God, and that any attempt to placate your ego through pursuit of personally defined happiness is bound to fail. Religion suggests that your bliss does not exist. Only God's bliss does. Greek teleology is utterly unconcerned with your personal definition of self-realization. The only thing that counts is whether you are acting virtuously in accordance with right reason. And capitalism cares far less about how you're feeling than about your ability to create products and services someone else wants. By calling self-realization the highest good, then, the new left had cast out the specter of the roots of Western civilization and replaced them with a call to action. What was that call to action? Forming alliances directed at tearing down the system. The theory went like this. Self-esteem is the key good, but self-esteem cannot be achieved while there are structural impediments to that self-esteem. Those structural impediments came in the form of sexism, racism, and other forms of bigotry. Such bigotry didn't have to be expressed outwardly. The structures of society themselves were institutionally biased against victim groups. And members of those victim groups couldn't achieve self-realization so long as those institutions remained standing. Second-wave feminists like Betty Friedan, 1921 to 2006, characterized the role of American women as the comfortable concentration camp. She argued, like other members of the New Left, that women were being prevented from achieving true happiness by the informal expectations of society. In The Feminine Mystique, 1963, she lamented, "A strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States." What had led to this unspoken suffering? Quoting Maslow, among others, Friedan argued that women had sold themselves out thanks to societal pressures, turning themselves into walking corpses. Feminist author Simone de Beauvoir, author of The Second Sex and existentialist partner of Sartre, went so far as to say that society should bar women from becoming mothers. No woman should be authorized to stay at home to raise her children. Society should be totally different. Women should not have that choice, precisely because if there is such a choice, too many women will make that one. It is a way of forcing women in a certain direction. Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the civil rights movement, which righteously fought against true institutionalized racism through legal structures, a new argument was made, that America was irredeemably racist and that such racism could never be overcome. Malcolm X argued in 1963 that even the pursuit of civil rights legislation was foolhardy. It would never solve our problems. Black Panther Honorary Prime Minister Stokely Carmichael, along with Charles Hamilton, wrote in 1967 in Black Power, The Politics of Liberation, that institutional racism went far too deep for anything but total systemic change to abrogate it. Racism is both overt and covert, they wrote. It takes two closely related forms, individual whites acting against individual blacks, and acts by the total white community against the black community. We call these individual racism and institutional racism. Institutional racism is vague and difficult to target, but we can tell it by its fruits. Wherever there is disparity, there is obviously discrimination. When black Americans lack proper food, shelter, and medical facilities, and thousands more are destroyed and maimed physically, emotionally, and intellectually because of conditions of poverty and discrimination in the black community, that is a function of institutional racism. White people may not be bombing churches anymore or stoning black families, but they are still supporting political officials and institutions that would and do perpetuate institutionally racist policies. Thus, political disagreement is merely a guise for covert racism. The only way for members of these victimized groups to restore their self-esteem would come by banding together to tear down the system. Feminist Gloria Steinem wrote that women and other victimized groups could not actually achieve self-esteem in the current system. To achieve self-esteem, victims would have to bond with others who share similar experiences, from groups of variously abled people to conferences of indigenous nations, bonding with others in shared power and taking one's place in a circle of true selves. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw of Columbia University came up with a term to describe this coalition of victims, intersectionality. According to Crenshaw, human beings are members of various groups, racial groups, gender groups, religious groups, sexual orientation groups. And we can describe their lived realities by referring to the intersection between those groups. Thus, a black female lesbian Muslim has a different lived reality than a white male heterosexual Christian. Furthermore, we can identify the level of difficulty someone has experienced in life simply by referencing the various groups of which she is a member. The more minority groups to which you are a member, the more you have been victimized. The more you have been victimized, the more your opinion about the innate institutional bigotry of the United States ought to carry weight. The actual goal, as Crenshaw acknowledges, is to bully those who aren't members of these intersectional groups, to force them to check their privilege. Crenshaw explains, acknowledging privilege is hard, particularly for those who also experience discrimination and exclusion. But acknowledge they must, or be accused of complicity in institutional racism. White citizens must recognize their white privilege or be cast out. Males must recognize their toxic masculinity. Identity politics becomes a path toward true justice. Repressive tolerance must be exercised against those who would fight the tribal notion of intersectionality. Those who refuse to abide by tribal dictates of intersectionality, people who insist that they are not victims of American society simply by dint of their skin color, are deemed sellouts, Uncle Toms. Thus, Clarence Thomas is not legitimately black because he doesn't vote Democrat. Nikki Haley isn't legitimately a woman because she is a pro-life Republican. According to Ta-Nehisi Coates, when black people call for individualistic thinking that strays from traditional democratic ideology, that means supporting white freedom. Freedom without consequence, freedom without criticism, freedom to be proud and ignorant. Victimhood triumphant. In order to promote discussions about intersectionality, systems of oppression must be curbed, including the speech of others. Discussions must end. Reason must be thrown out the window since, owing to our different life experiences, we cannot understand one another. Freedom, supposedly a tool of the white power structure, itself must be redefined so as to protect the self-realization of intersectional people. Science, too, must take a backseat. Science might undercut the intersectional argument by providing evidence that not all suffering springs from institutional discrimination. Say, for example, that social science shows a high correlation between single motherhood and crime, and that single motherhood is especially predominant among American blacks. Or say that there are group differences in IQ, and that those differences may be at least partially heritable. Or say that men and women are biologically different, and that this difference explains differences in pay, since women choose different types of jobs than men and make different decisions with regard to the number of hours worked, their pay tends to be lower on average than that of men. Or say that gender is connected with sex, and that males who believe they are female are not in fact female. These basic facts become subject to scrutiny, since science itself is a construct of the system. That's the argument of Donna Hughes in the Women's Studies International Forum, who explains, "The scientific method is a tool for the construction and justification of dominance in the world. The new methodological techniques were invented by men who are interested in explaining the inheritance of traits in order to support their political ideology of natural human superiority and inferiority.